Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
The Drew style, like mountain bread that you cook on a wok. You cook it on a saj, but you can take like a $5 wok and flip it upside down and cook it. So if you're going to wrap up the lamb shawarma, that would be it.
I think the sabich recipe is really cool because it's a sandwich that's popular in Israel, but nobody's heard of it. But it's also quintessentially Israeli because it came from Iraqi Jews, but sabich doesn't exist in Iraq as a sandwich.
We are back in the studio with Philly-based chef, owner, author Michael Solomonov and his restaurateur partner and co-author Stephen Cook. Their most recent collaborations are the book Israeli Soul and The Rooster. So you guys are busy, man.
Like, you're busy.
You don't stand still, do you?
We like opening restaurants. I don't know why.
But you've had to close a couple, too. That's painful, right?
Oh, it seems like a good idea at the time. And then you got to run them.
So let's talk about Israeli Soul, which is a really cool book. Although I have to tell you, it's a really heavy book. I put it in my backpack. I tried to put the Zahav book and Israeli Soul in my backpack, and my back hurt.
Yeah, well, if you carry each one in an arm, you're basically getting like arm exercises wherever you go.
Yes, it's true. What I noticed when I read the book is you have an almost anthropological approach to the subject of Israeli food.
For me, that came secondary. I think the anthropological aspect of it is something that is just what it is. It wasn't the angle. The angle was going to Israel, literally just flying to Israel, getting on a bus and going to eat. And the rest of it sort of came
from that. I love that kind of angle. I'm sorry I didn't get to go with you guys.
You should have come. It was pretty sick.
Yeah, we had 82 restaurants in the 8 days we had.
Get out of here. Yeah. You know, when I wrote my pizza book, people think that's impressive because I went to Naples and ate 25 pizzerias in 6 days.
Ugh. But pizza's hard.
You get extra credit for pizza because that really tells you off.
What was your best? What was the best bite?
You know, it's interesting.
Top three, I guess. Best bite
was actually not pizza because one of the things I got into trouble with the pizza police was because I said the best pizza in the world is not in Naples.
Ooh.
You know, and then like, but I went to this restaurant and now I'm, was it called Matozzi? I can't remember the name of it. And I had all this great Neapolitan food, but not, and they make really good pizza, but it was, you know, to this day, I still think that Chris Bianco is making better pizza than anything you can get in Naples, although the guy outside Naples is doing apparently amazing food. I haven't been.
Like, Naples was what everybody, I don't know. We make very good pizza here. There's very good pizza here in the States, you know?
Especially now, well, more than ever, there's, you know, Anthony Mangieri, and you, in Philly, you've had a lot, you've had a few good, you know. What's it called?
Bedia.
Bedia,
yeah. So and good. Apparently, has he reopened now?
No, he hasn't. I think in a couple months he's going to do it. But it is so good. When you get a Bedia pizza, it is just like, and it's non-traditional. I mean,
everyone tells me that.
It's ridiculously
good. And I'm a little
good.
Embarrassed to say that, you know, your pizza hasn't been to.
You should be embarrassed.
Can't All right, well,
no, most people
you know,
haven't
had it. Don't rub it in.
He made 20 pies a night, so most people haven't had
it. That was the only time where I would ever, like, take, I don't know, whenever I would sort of cross the line and, like, call somebody on their phone and be like, it's Michael Solomonov, I need, like, a pizza. Because I'm like, I'm not waiting for 3 hours.
Right.
I can't do that.
It's
you know?
The only time you, where the subtext of your phone call is, do you know who I am?
Do you know what my last name is? No, I'd be like, Joe, I will give you as much hummus as you want. I need pizza now. Tell me when. And it wasn't like, come right now. He's like, all right, come at 10:15.
Right.
Be on time and I will have a pie for you.
Right.
You know?
So you traded.
It wasn't that. I wasn't like, he didn't, it was.
I know. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
So why this book now?
Well, we had written Zahav, and that was really the story, looking at the food through the prism of the restaurant, you know, which is not in Israel. And that was really Mike's story. And that narrative there was Mike's story. And for Israeli Soul, as Mike said, we wanted to bring people to Israel. I mean, this book is as much travel guide as it is.
It is. I was about, that's on one of my list of questions. It's like, I feel like I want to go to Israel just to try all the places that you guys mentioned.
You could take, you could get a plane ticket, take this book, and you're good for like a few weeks.
If it's too heavy, get the ebook version.
There you go. Or just rip off the binder. But even our friend who has his own travel company that coordinated all the logistics, that knows all of these restaurants, is featured in the book as well. So you can just give him a call.
All right. That's great. So this was supposed to be Israel's story more than Mike's story.
Correct. And to your question about sort of anthropological nature of it, I mean, Mike kind of just in his DNA understands, you know, I think he understands the sort of synthesis of cultures that is Israeli cuisine. But for me, and when we were writing this, you know, the way that I'm a sort of linear person, and I wanted to try to understand it in a way that we could have the reader understand it. The stories of all these cultures that have come together in the last, let's say, 100 years and evolved a cuisine that was already there and brought in new traditions. And so we tried to not just gloss over things that people might have questions about. We tried to sort of go in and explain where these things come from and where these traditions come from and what makes them Israeli.
Which is great, because I have to say that I was sort of ignorant. I didn't realize until I read the book, how much of Israeli cuisine is by definition hyphenated.
That's right. I mean, you know, most Israelis are a few generations away from their family coming from a totally different part of the world. And
right. It could be North Africa, it could be Russia, it could be anywhere.
Right.
Anywhere.
And so those foods sort of, you know, they left that region in the, you know, second century and then, you know, became informed by the different stops along the way of those groups and picked up things along the way, but always sort of around a central theme of kashrut.
Explain what kashrut is.
The kosher laws, the sort of basic Jewish practices around eating.
I love what you guys say about kosher. I don't know if it was in the Zahav book or was it in Israeli Soul. You know, you had a really funny riff about this whole notion of what's kosher and what's not, and you know, and how you don't judge people. But as you know, people get very, very exercised about this.
Well, they do, and it's also such a personal thing. I mean, people bend rules all the time. People have, like, we grew up in my household, there would never be like a pork chop, like that would not be acceptable. But like the moment we would leave, it was like bacon cheeseburgers, and for some reason, shrimp was like somehow okay.
In my house, we lived in Miami, and we would never bring in any pork into the house. But during stone crab season, we would just like
that's so funny.
Pile them on the table.
You know, Calvin Trillett.
Wait, you would have it in your house?
Oh yeah, from Publix.
That's,
yeah.
That's awesome. Calvin Trillett always talks about the famous barbecue easement from the Rebbe in Joplin that allows him to eat pork
the
barbecue.
Special dispensation. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. We have people that come into the restaurant that are like, so we don't do our version of kashrut at Zahav, or kosher style, is we don't have shellfish or pork at all, and we don't mix milk and meat on one plate, right? So we have cheese dishes, we have dairy, but then we also have meat, and they don't touch, right? So we'll have people that will come in that are like, I'm kosher, which would mean, really, if they were like kosher, they would never come into a restaurant.
Right, exactly.
But
you
be
need
like,
two kitchens and, you know, the whole
thing. Well, it's just we're not, we don't have a mashgiach, we don't, whatever. And then, but then they'll be like, can you order a kosher chicken? Which we'll, of course, we'll do. But then it's like, you know, you're cooking on a like non-kosher apparatus. And then there'll be people that'll say, can you make the lafa but serve it to me on a plastic plate? And I'm like, whatever, you do you. And I'm going to do me. And I'm going to, you know, as long as you like this, that is totally fine.
Yeah,
in terms of defining Israeli cuisine, you know, that is what helped, because all the immigrants coming from Yemen and North Africa and Bulgaria, they had a certain style in which they cooked, right? The laws of kashrut were pertinent. And there was always Shabbat. I mean, besides the rest of the Jewish holidays that usually have food to help symbolize or identify which holiday, there was always Shabbat, which meant that Friday after sundown, you couldn't turn things on and off. Ovens were always low. The cassoulet,
right?
Came from Jewish cooking. I mean,
sure.
Like, there's chamin, there's cholent, there's the Yemenite bread, which we have an Israeli sole, which is Cubana, you know, it's cooked overnight, you know, and that, and you're also commanded basically to eat a luxurious meal on the Shabbat, the day of rest, on Saturday, but you also can't turn things on and off. So it's like, you got to get creative. So it wasn't like, it wasn't food from Yemen and Morocco. It was Jewish food. And that, and that came to this land that was already Levantine, that was Palestinian, not just from like from the West Bank or from the Galilee, but also from Gaza. And there were Druze and there were Bedouins and there was like all, and there was the spice in the Silk Road, right? And there was, I don't know, there was like the modern and ancient agriculture that really was started there. You know, so there's just so much. There's
right.
just so much.
And I think it's interesting because I don't think any of us knew that until you opened Zahav. And now I think you've opened a lot of people's minds, not just because I know you take people to Israel and all that, but it's it goes beyond that. I mean, and it I was struck by, after reading Israeli Soul, just how vibrant the food culture is because of this collision cultures.
It's the best.
It's insane. Best. And so I have a question about how you guys go about writing your books, including Israeli Soul. So I noticed that one of Savor's founding editors, Dorothy Callens, is mentioned. What is the process like?
Dorothy's amazing. She really, I mean, she's produced all of our books and, you know, has sort of the clout to get the freedom from the publisher to kind of do it how we want to do it. Put the team together that we, you know, our own team, a photographer and Mike Persico and Don Morris, the designer, and Dorothy. I feel like we were sort of under this protective umbrella that maybe is starting to appreciate is not the norm.
Well, Dorothy also, right, I mean, she sort of taught us. We became fluent in this process from her, you know. Mm-hmm. Originally with Zahav, we tried a writer, and then
tried the usual collaborator writer.
We did actually. One of my good friends, who's a fantastic writer, but it just didn't click. And Steve wrote like a sample chapter, and then we were like, I guess Steve's gonna write the book. And Dorothy was like, you know, Steve seems like he knows what he's doing. And the idea, I think, was that she would kind of help write and that we could edit or whatever. And then it was like Steve wrote the book. I mean,
well, we wrote it together. I physically typed it, but I mean, we, you know, we've spent more of the last 13 years of our lives together than with any other person, including spouses. And
so you can literally finish each other's sentences.
Exactly. So, I mean, particularly with Zahav, which was more Mike's story, you know, a lot of it I tried to, you know, some of it was just direct quotes that I had in my head from having these conversations with Mike. Some of it was me sort of trying to channel Mike. But we spent hours talking about everything in the book. And yeah, I mean, you know, Mike, it's hard to keep Mike sitting down behind a computer, but.
I can't imagine that, given, I just feel that Mike is kind of a peripatetic, restless soul. I don't know why I say that.
Nail on the head.
So, if you had to tell people three reasons to travel to Israel to eat, what would you say?
Because of the way that so many different cultures have established themselves in Israel within the last several generations, I think that there's an attachment to tradition that is really special and something that we see probably less of in America. As food obsessed as we are now, it's about what's new and hot.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about doing something, perfecting something over generations, doing one thing, handing it off to your children. And that's really an inspiring way, I think, to think about food. And I think it comes through in how it tastes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that was really always eye-opening to me when I go to Israel, because we're sort of engaged in this American food industry and trying to be successful and playing this game. And over there, it's like the business is sort of secondary. I mean, they support their families by maybe having, you know, one falafel shop that is, you know, been passed from generation to generation to generation that has supported this entire family. And I think the singularity of the way that they approach things there is really inspiring.
All right. What about you, Mike?
There is just an energy in that country that I just, like, haven't really experienced anywhere else. And I think that food is a really big part of it. But, you know, it's this the way that the food has sort of symbolized the human aspect of it and the different cultures and all the traditions is just, it's just fascinating. And it's so bright and it's so vibrant.
Right. And it's alive. It's
well, it's living and breathing, and it tells so many stories that are so important to us right now.
Yeah, it's
so
interesting because I saw the Phil Rosenthal show that was about Israel, and one of the things that he says, and you were in it, right, I believe,
yep.
He was surprised by how complex. There's a million Israels.
Mm-hmm.
If you read the newspaper, you think there's one Israel.
Right, and that's probably the reason that, like, opening Zahav was so important to me personally, but I think there's just a lot of different conversations, and I think that sort of starting through food, and as hokey as this is, I would have made fun of myself a few years ago. The fact of the matter is diplomacy on an actual level is, like, not working, right? And I think that there is a way to do it, and there is a way to capture the message that people are trying to say about themselves with food.
Yeah.
And I think that you can do that literally walking down up and down a street basically anywhere in Israel. And it comes with love, as Steve was saying. It's this sort of dynasty of people making the same things that they brought with them from far corners of the earth, right? Back to this place. It's the one thing that they've made, that they've fed multiple generations of families with this one sandwich, and they still to this day make that
right.
sandwich for you. It
right.
is like the flavors are unbelievable. All the produce is from within 100 miles.
Right.
Not to be cool, not because locality
right. not
is
because
like a
food trend. Locavore-ism
exactly.
has taken over the country.
But every Persian cucumber, right, that has not been ever genetically modified, that has been growing using like whatever, brackish water in the desert or something, comes from, you know, it's never sat on a truck for 2 or 3 days, you know? And I think it's amazing. And it's not just that, it's the way that these cultures spill onto each other, the way they've adapted, and the way that you can see what Israeli cuisine is by going into somebody's home on Shabbat and having one parent from Poland, one parent from Yemen, and seeing what that means while you eat it, you
yeah.
know?
You didn't really write that much about the whole Palestinian question. Can you imagine what they would serve at some meaningful Israeli-Palestinian peace talks?
I know what I'm going to serve
okay.
at that peace talk,
okay.
and I'm not quite sure yet, but I think it's more about it's funny because we're going to, just by having a book called Israeli Soul,
right.
opens it up. You
sure.
know? And that was, I'm very, very good friends. One of my best friends is Reem Cassis, who wrote The Palestinian Table. And she and I, like, we've become very fast friends. And, you know, and it certainly that, even now as we promote this book, I really think about what that means to her, and,
mm-hmm.
and it's super complicated, you know. And I have to say, since I've become very close to her, and my kids and her kids play together, and they know nothing about this conflict.
Right.
They live in Philly. We live in Philly. They know nothing about this conflict. And I, this year, so Israeli Independence Day is right after Israeli Memorial Day. They do it on purpose in Israel because everyone's like super sad, and then
right.
fireworks go off, and you know, and the two times that we've won the Chef Beard Awards, it's landed on Israeli Independence Day.
Wow.
Right? So it's a big deal, right? We went Outstanding
right.
Chef on
right.
Yom Ha'atzmaut, and you know, and this year for Memorial Day, Reem invited me to her house to talk about my brother, to like celebrate my brother.
Wow.
Right? And I was like, and then the following day is a day that I've always celebrated and I continue to and I'd be proud of, but it also she celebrates it by, you know, it's Nakba. It's like when her family was pushed out of their village in Palestine, you know? And it's, I think that we can dance around the stuff as much as we want, but at some point, this is something that we're going to have to discuss. And I think that by hiding, it's just not, it fuels a lot of things that aren't necessary. Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah. At some point, it would be really nice to use the popularity that we've had, and even on both sides, to really to move sure. things forward.
So what would you serve? You said you know what you'd serve.
I would serve borekas. And
which are sort of flaky.
Which are the Balkan pastries. Yeah. And those
flaky,
are
flaky, savory turnovers.
Exactly. And those were my grandmother's. And those are like delicious.
I associate those with Albania.
Well, everybody's got the borek. I mean, everybody's got their version of that. Yeah. And the Ottomans are the ones that kind of spread it around a lot. But the dough, I think, came from medieval Spain. I would do that, and this is like hilarious, but I feel like schnitzel, man. Like, everybody loves schnitzel, and like awesome. Whenever we cook for the kids, that's like what everyone has to have.
It's true. Everyone does love schnitzel, and you have a whole section of the book about schnitzel. I love the way you divide the book into, first of all, it's all the things I like to eat. Mm-hmm. So, and there were some surprises, like the organ meat sandwich. Yeah. You know, and it's really fun. So like it. Are there three recipes that you would encourage people to make from the book right away? First of all, I have to start with the 2-minute hummus because I can't believe that
It's 5 minutes, but
you've increased the productivity 250%.
So, but even at 5-minute hummus, you imply in the book that the 5-minute hummus will get you 90% of the way of your unbelievably delicious.
I think the 5-minute hummus is awesome.
I would stand by that. I mean, we started when we published the Zaha book and we published the recipe that we actually use. It's not a difficult recipe, but it requires some planning ahead. Yeah, you have to soak the chickpeas, and depending on how old your chickpeas are, which you won't know until you start cooking them, it could take a while. So we wanted something that was there had to be something in between the sort of cold, stiff supermarket hummus and this, you know, one day affair. So a pet peeve of mine, it's like when somebody asks me to take a jar of tahina and measure a portion of it, it's a mess. And the cleanup is almost makes it not worth it. So we wanted to come up with a recipe that A, could use canned chickpeas, B, could be made very, very quickly so people would actually make it, cheaper, by the way, than what you can buy in the supermarket, and where, you know, you wouldn't have a lot of cleanup. And so it's 2 cans of chickpeas, it's a whole jar of tahina, you pour it in, you throw it out. It's a lemon, it's a piece of garlic, salt, cumin, boom, ice water, 5 minutes.
I love that. 2 more.
I love our lamb shawarma in this. I think it's so good. It's a lamb shoulder roast that's spiced, slow roasted, and then you rest it and slice it and crisp it in a pan. And it tastes like shawarma. It tastes like shawarma on the street. It's so good. And actually,
Bad shawarma in the world.
There is a lot of bad shawarma. Yeah. It's where they hide all the bad meat.
And then I would say the third thing would be with the mountain bread, because you can make it. It's the Druze style, like mountain bread that you cook on a wok. You cook it on a saj, but you can take like a $5 wok and flip it upside down and cook it in your
pot.
And it makes the best wrap. So if you're going to wrap up the lamb shawarma or something, that would be it. What would be your other thing?
I think the sabich recipe is really cool because it's a sandwich that's popular in Israel, but nobody's heard of it. But it's also one of these things that is quintessentially Israeli because it came from Iraqi Jews, but sabich doesn't exist in Iraq as a sandwich. They came to Israel. They adapted to the culture of stuffing anything inside of a pita.
Right. So we should explain that sabich sandwich is fried eggplant.
Fried eggplant, slow-cooked eggs, hard-cooked eggs. Amba, which is a pickled mango condiment that traces its roots in Iraq to Jewish traders in India. And some of those things, the fried eggplant and especially the eggs, would have been cooked in this overnight stew, the Iraqi overnight stew. And they would have, before they went to synagogue on Saturday morning, they would have plucked the eggs out of the stew and eaten that for breakfast. So in Israel, where everything ends up inside of a pita, you have the eggplant, you have the eggs, you have the amba, which is this sort of pungent, funky, sweet, savory, sour sauce. And then, you know, you add chopped salad, of course, and tahina, of course, and some harif, some spicy.
Ceviche is probably my favorite in New York.
It's very good. Taim. Yep, yeah. It's great. And it's a vegetarian sandwich that really, it packs a punch. And I think it's cool because it was brought by Iraqi Jews, but only exists in Israel and New York.
Yeah, Einat's is like amazing. She makes great ceviche. But it's really like a mouthful of fried eggplant and a pita is just as good as it gets.
Yeah. So tell us about The Rooster.
The Rooster is a restaurant that we opened a little less than 2 years ago. And to cut to the chase, 100% of the profits of that restaurant go to support the mission of our nonprofit partner. There's an amazing organization in Philadelphia called Broad Street Hospitality Collaborative. They do meals and social services for vulnerable Philadelphians, about 70,000 meals a year. But they do it, they really view themselves as being in the hospitality business. I mean, if you're a guest at Broad Street, you will get seated by a host. You'll be served a 3-course meal cooked by a professional chef, a table with linens and china. And we got involved with them as an organization and were so moved that we had to figure out a way to get more involved. And while this was happening, Federal Donuts, which was our fried chicken and donut concept, was growing. And we were getting these beautiful chickens in and cutting them up for frying and throwing the backs in the garbage. And as we grew, we have 5 of them now, we started to count how much chicken we were throwing away every week, and it was hundreds if not thousands of pounds. So we said, well, you know, a couple of Jewish boys know what to do with chicken backs, you know,
right.
Make chicken soup.
Lots of ball soup.
That's right. So the first idea was to just, we'll make soup, Broad Street will serve it to its guests, you know, done deal. But the idea of a soup kitchen is sort of a dirty word at Broad Street because that conjures up all these sort of Dickensian images, and they're really about dignity and hospitality and the power of hospitality. So went back to the drawing board and we came up with what I think was a better idea, which was, what if we had a restaurant where you and I could come in and eat, spend $10 on lunch like we might do any other day, and know that 100% of the proceeds of that lunch are going, you know, essentially you eat lunch at Rooster, someone else at Broad Street, their meal is paid for. And the backbone of that restaurant was originally and still is soup made from this food, this food waste. And it's evolved. Soup doesn't sell so well in the summer, so we've sort of evolved the concept. But it's a Jewish, a Jewish deli, diner, luncheonette.
Pastrami sandwiches, right?
Pastrami sandwiches.
And are you making your own pastrami or buying it?
We do. Yeah, we make it.
We're doing smoked meat. We're doing like smoked meat. We're doing corned beef.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah.
In fact, that's another thing you guys didn't bring. Okay, so the list
hungry.
Is getting
I could
longer
go for it
and
right
longer.
Now. It's pretty delicious.
You know, so it's really your guys' way of paying it forward in a really direct way.
Well, it's, you know, if people in the hospitality business aren't going to look out for the vulnerable among us, who do we expect to do that work? And so it's a small thing that we're doing, but I think with the platform that we have, we can sort of spread the word and Philadelphia's food scene is incredible, and we benefited from that, but it's also a very poor city, too.
Yeah.
And a lot of people can't afford the hospitality that we make our living sort of supplying every day.
Yeah. You know, we have to do a truncated version of the all-you-can-answer buffet on special sauce for you, too. So, but I'm going to ask you to answer individually. Only 3 questions. So, Stephen, who's at your Last Supper?
I'm kicking myself because I listened to the show and
that's
I should have known this
Don't
was coming
worry.
And I
yeah,
feel totally
you,
prepared.
You know, then it's your fault, man.
It's my fault. Mike, you want to go first on
All
this
right.
one?
I'll go.
Okay.
I feel like I was so obsessed with Jimi Hendrix as a kid. This would be a perfect opportunity for it.
Absolutely, and especially because, you know, Paul Allen just died and he built the Jimi Hendrix Museum.
I grew up in Miami and I was a diehard Miami Dolphins fan and Dan Marino was my hero growing up, and I actually met him from Pittsburgh. Actually, my father-in-law has like a signed Dan Marino Pitt jersey in his office.
So Dan Marino and Jimi Hendrix get the same
the same table. This is a pretty like a lowbrow.
Yeah. So what about, would there be, is there a chef or a food person you'd want there? Was there a politician you'd want there?
I feel like it's if you're, it's your last supper and you're about to die, can there be a politician that you would then try to kill? And can I talk about that?
That's a really complicated. Yeah, really
we game, all know who game, it is,
you're,
right?
You're, yeah. You're really gaming the system, yeah.
I think there's so many chefs that we'd like, I'd love to hang out with. I feel like any of the old French chefs would be fun. Like, I just would like to see what it would be like to hang out with, like, Escoffier or whatever for a minute. Right. But
or Julia Child.
Julia Child. Julia Child would I would be... love to have a meal with Jacques Pepin. He was actually the dean at the culinary school that I went to, but I never really got a chance to.
Kenji used to swear by La Technique.
It's an amazing book. Cooked my way through that book.
For people that don't know, that's Jacques Pepin's sort of, it's one of the scholarly.
And there's great how-to photographs, step by step.
Yeah, it's really intimidating, though. Watching him peel celery root is like, it's makes you realize that you don't know anything. Because it he takes a paring knife and it looks like, it looks like the celery root just sort of came like that. It's really good.
What are you guys eating at Last Supper?
Dim sum.
Okay.
I think dim sum would just be the way to go.
Like just a combination of dumplings, chicken feet, could be anything.
Not
right?
chicken feet. It would be mostly dumplings. It would be taro rolls. It would be like sauteed pea greens with like garlic.
Ooh, and that I kind love of thing. Sauteed.
I love that.
I like the idea of dim sum. What
yeah,
about
I would. Steak? I would start with a bowl of pho and then finish with a pastrami sandwich.
I like the way you guys think. Though.
Pastrami
this
sandwich
good.
Dipped in pho, I'm just saying, would be fantastic.
So, it's just been declared Michael Solomonov Day all over the world. Tell me what's happening.
It's like, makes me like sick and scared. Michael Solomonov Day?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Like, how would people be celebrating?
I don't know, man. I don't. What about Steve Cook Day?
Steve Cook Day, everybody's...
It'd be like Bowl of Pastrami.
Yeah, everybody's sitting.
Dan Marino.
Everybody's sitting quietly doing a crossword puzzle.
Everyone's sitting quietly doing a crossword puzzle. I like that. What about you?
I think there would probably be a very strong emphasis on recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. You know, there are these great 12-step meetings that are on the beach in Margate, New Jersey, where I like, where I surf a lot. So we'd probably have like a little surfing, a little
I like this.
Fried clam on hot dog buns and a 12-step meeting. Yeah.
Yeah. So people would be confronting their weaknesses and eating fried clams on hot dog rolls.
And
I
surfing.
Love this.
Yeah.
I love Michael Solomonov Day. Well, you guys, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much
for having us on.
Oh, it's been really fun. Michael Solomonov and Stephen Cook, do check out their latest book, Israeli Soul, and their latest project, The Rooster, which I'm going to go have a pastrami sandwich and a bowl of chicken soup. And nobody's food life is complete in this country without a trip to Sahav. So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.